Hello and welcome to the Squawker Talker Euro 2020 podcast. And just like the competition itself, we are powering on into the crunch time that is the semi-finals. Four teams left as the battle to be crowned as the Kings of Europe will be decided in the next 7 days. And on the back of yet another big name exit at the quarterfinal stage, there are now three games, yes, just three games at Wembley before we all know who will be getting their hands on the biggest prize in European football. So absolutely no room for mistakes, no slips, no trips, no flips in the final four. And on today's show, we will be previewing both games as England, Denmark, Italy and Spain go all out for glory. England, they find themselves back at Wembley as they take on the Danes. And that's where we'll be getting ourselves started in part one of the show. Is it coming home? Is it not coming home? Or are you just a bit sick of all this home speculation? And then in part two, we pop over to the other side of the draw as Euro 2012 winners Spain take on Roberto Mancini and Italy. Right then, let's get started. My name's Fergal Brennan, and as anybody knows, in a tournament, you need cool heads, calmness and consistency. So it is an unchanged lineup today from the last eight. Leading the troops, we have Squawker's chief football writer, Mohamed Butt. Mo, how's things?
I'm pretty tired. Up till 5 a.m. watching the Argentina game, working the Argentina game. But, you know, Copa America's keeping me tired. But, you know, that's almost coming to an end as well. So it's just a few more days of intense grind and then I can sleep normally. But the Euros, I'm very excited. I'm just tired. Tired and wired.
And the legs either side of Mo in midfield, we have La Liga pair, Ewan McTare and Alan Feely. Ewan, how are you doing?
Yeah, good. No, I'm excited. This is the best week of the tournament. You know, semi-final week is better than the finals because you've got two big games and sometimes the final is a little bit rubbish once we actually get into it. Semi-finals are usually cracking, so to have two Euro semi-finals this week, Copa America semis as well, I'm excited. So this podcast should also be the best podcast of the tournament as well, then, by that theory.
Alan, that's a hell of a build-up. Are you as confident as you in about the semis and about the podcast?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's going to be a really interesting week. I think both semi-finals are really finely poised. It's hard to pick a winner in both of them. And also the Copa America, we look like we could be on course for a Brazil-Argentina final, which would be something special. Neymar and Messi both going at it in good form. So yeah, I'm really excited about the week's football and also this podcast.
Great stuff. Right, England, where we're obviously going to get ourselves started. Mo, as usual, you are proud / de facto England fan, reporter, correspondent, expert, everything in between. 4-0 win over Ukraine in the quarterfinal. Harry Kane with another two goals. Harry Maguire with his first England goal of the tournament and Jordan Henderson with his first England goal ever. Now, on the one hand, there's a huge amount of positives to take from the game in terms of the results and the professionalism and the fact that at no stage, 2-0, 3-0, 4-0, did England really let their performance level drop. But it was only Ukraine. And to be absolutely straight about it, they were very poor. Anything that was kind of expected from them were just, they were just deflated after that early goal from Kane. So before we get into the semi-final in detail, what can England take from the quarterfinal? Professional results. Is there really much more that can be analysed from it?
No, there's plenty that I can take from it. But it definitely was the case that it was Ukraine were not on the same level as England. Like, this was a worry, right? This is what I said in the last pod. I was like, Sweden would have been a better team than Ukraine, quality-wise, but they would have just sort of sat there and defended. Whereas Ukraine, England are much better than Ukraine, but Ukraine have a sort of fight and spirit about them. They could do something. Now, yeah, we saw first half, really, the fighting spirit when obviously they lost the defender and they had to bring on Chankov and the winger and they switched to a 4-3-3. And instantly England were like completely flabbergasted what the hell to do. They could not live with the pace in behind of Chankov and the way that Ukraine kept moving the ball down that left flank. They kept killing John Stones and Kyle Walker over and over and over and over and over again. And it was, and England had no answer for that. And if Ukraine had just had a little bit more quality in the final third, or if Harry Maguire and Luke Shaw hadn't been, and Jordan Henderson hadn't been on such sharp form, England could have found themselves getting pegged back. And this is, but you know, in the second half, we saw in Southgate, must have said in the half, said, lads, it's Ukraine, you know, sort of like the older Sir Alex Ferguson team tour against Spurs, like, lads, it's Ukraine, you know. So then England stepped up the game second half, and they didn't change formation, didn't change team players, just up their intensity levels, and it was too much because the quality gap was too big. when England's players played at their intensity and at the intense level, you know, that's too much. And again, Luke Shaw just decided, just took the game away from the opponents, just like he did against Germany. Luke Shaw was like, right, lads, don't worry about it. I'll sort it out, you know, and took the game away from Germany, took the game away from them, just like he did against Germany. Two assists, two really good crosses. So, and that was it, really. That was all she wrote. And then England had time to make some big subs, get some key minutes of squad players. Henderson scoring, you could see that meant a lot to him. It was mostly just a sort of, if the Germany win was a big sort of mental blockade, mental hurdle to get over, like beating Germany in knockout football, holy smokes, amazing. This was more of like a sort of like just a celebration, the whole squad to come together and play really well and just sort of have a nice, comfortable win, right? Like, and they went away from Wembley, they got away from Wembley, and they didn't have the pressure of Wembley, and they could just sort of play a bit more freer. And also could prove to themselves that it's not just the home advantage. It's not just the crowd roaring us on. We can do this. We are good ourselves, you know? And they were. And they dominated Ukraine. And it's not that they can take too much of it going forward, but it's what the result gives them, if that makes sense. They're not going to learn anything about the team from Ukraine. Not really. They're not going to, you know, it just gives, like, Luke Shaw is now in even better form than he was after the Germany game. Harry Maguire is in even better form. Raheem Sterling is figuring out that, oh, I don't just have the squad, I can create goals. Harry Kane, as bad as he's played all tournament, and he wasn't even good against Ukraine, he scored 3 goals in 2 games now.
Ewan, when you look at the performance in terms of England, as Mo said, there is some things to take, but it always comes with that little asterisk of it's Ukraine. And I wouldn't say it's only Ukraine. They got themselves through to the knockout stages and deserve to be there. But the most important thing that England fans have learnt about England is the space inside their head rather than the ball at their feet. All of the post-match comments, Southgate, Kane, Harry Maguire, all focused in on this idea of mentality. And that's, generally speaking, in international tournaments, that is what wins the day. The mental strength to get through certain games and the right approach. And there was a point in the second half, and obviously with a reduced crowd, you can hear more shouting that goes on the pitch. And you could hear Maguire, Henderson, Rice shouting, standards, don't let this drop. Don't let your efforts drop. Don't let this drop. That is going to be England's trump card, because this kind of holy grail of an incredible performance that England fans are waiting for might never come. But they have got the mentality as it stands to go on and win this tournament.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think this game was important mentally more than footballistically, because they've learned a little bit more about who the leaders are, who can step up. As we say about Sterling, he's maybe realised a bit better what his role is, how he plays off Kane, how he can do that and just be incredible at creating and scoring the goals, which he's been doing too. I think it was just a learning experience, which is great when it's a quarterfinal of a major tournament. You know, all you just want to do is win. If you can learn stuff along the way, then fantastic. And yeah, I think one of the keys is Luke Shaw and those crosses in and the headers. You know, I mean, remember when England were at the World Cup in Russia and they went to the semi-finals, it was all about the set pieces and to get another couple goals that way, to get the headers. Between that World Cup and the Euros now, England have got 10 headed goals. Nobody else in that time has more than 4 headed goals, no other country. So this has been a strength of theirs for some time. It's good to once again show that they can do this. Even the Germany game, it's, you know, crosses, low balls in from wide. They know that they can just kind of put it in the mixer and things will happen. The problem maybe is, and we'll get on to it, they're playing Denmark, who are maybe one of the best back threes at clearing these balls into the box. But it's just really good confidence for England to know that if they need to do that, they can do it. And to have Shaw with all that confidence is fantastic, because he's the left back from now until the end of the tournament, no doubt about that.
Alan, as Ewan says, Luke Shaw has kind of risen up a couple of notches. Mo and any other United fans don't really need to be reminded how impressive he's been, particularly in the last 12 months. But Jadon Sancho was arguably the big call that Southgate made in terms of his starting lineup. There's been massive clamour to get him in the team. There's obviously been the speculation over his move to United. That now seems to be settled, and he himself seems to be settled. He almost got himself a goal. He almost kind of made a match-winning contribution before he got subbed off. But based on what we saw of him, particularly in the first half, that shows what he can offer in comparison to a Grealish, in comparison to a Foden. Given the fact that so many parts of this England side are tied down, probably 8 or 9 players are nailed on to start against Denmark, has he done enough to keep his starting place in Southgate's mind?
I wouldn't try and second guess Southgate, I don't think. I think that he's actually managing the squad an interesting way, a very different way in the way he's using it. It's almost like he's using it as a game, and he's bringing on players to last 20 minutes when they're full of energy, full of running, full of legs, you know? I mean, to be able to bring in a player of Sancho's calibre into a game in the quarterfinal of a tournament is incredible, you know, after him not playing a minute before that. And to be able to rest the likes of Foden and Grealish is a similar kind of flex, you could say. So I think that bringing in Mount, bringing in Sancho, and also having the attacking talents of Grealish and Foden there as well bodes very well going forward, because they're all hungry for minutes, they're all not guaranteed of their place, and they're all flair players in many ways, so that kind of pressure would befit them more than it would a position like centre back or centre forward, where it's better to be trusted and kind of win that performance over time, if that makes sense. So I think that, you know, his midfield kind of double pivot is kind of locked down at this point. That's not going to change, I'd imagine, for the rest of the tournament. And having that flexibility is really good, not just from England's perspective, but also from the opposition's perspective, because they can't guess what kind of attacking system going to be running, do you know, because there's so much flexibility there. So yeah, I think that, you know, Sterling's experience and his kind of caliber as a leader and a player makes him undroppable at this point. But I think there's definitely an open slot for that other kind of wide position and the kind of free attacker, you could say. But I agree with the guys completely. I think that that result was as much a pressure release as it was a footballing performance, in terms of, you know, the German game was very heavy. There was fear going into it. There was tension. Whereas that was a real just kind of footballing expression. And they're going into the semi-final now, a very tight game, but having had that moment of pressure that they passed in Germany, and also that kind of moment of exaltation that they enjoyed against Ukraine. So I think that they're in a really, really good spot, you know, in terms of physical fitness, in terms of mentality, in terms of psychology, going into that final game before the final, if they make it there.
Mo, before we talk about Denmark, we've got to talk about Raheem Sterling. Again, key man for England, just as he's been so far this tournament. And yes, Harry Kane got his two goals, and there is always going to be attention on Kane as captain and as a bit of a media darling, particularly in the UK. But Sterling, we're seeing how Sterling is able to be both things. He's able to be both the spark, and he's able to be the most consistent and best player in the team. And like I said before about Shaw, as a United fan, you'll need no telling about that. City fans don't need to be told just how good and how consistent Sterling is. But I think pre-tournament, there was still this conception that, yeah, you know, he can do this and he can do this, but can he be, quote, relied on? Given the way that he's performed this tournament, there can be no more doubts from anybody about just how good and just how effectual Sterling is.
There can be none. He's really proven, like, just how good he actually is. Like, there's always been a doubt about Sterling. It's, I don't want a doubt, really, but a weird sort of vibe about him, and that he's clearly been good, great even. But if you look at Man City in the pressure moments, in the big European Cup moments, it's not really, he's not really ever stood up except for that disallowed goal against Spurs, which was disallowed in the end. And he, while he does really well in the league games, again, if you look at City's big games and the big games they've won, it's not usually been him doing the business. It's usually been someone else, De Bruyne, Aguero, whoever that may be. But what he's been consistent. He's a consistent dribbler, consistent mover off the ball, consistent playmaker. And so it's always looked like, okay, this guy's really, really good. But is he really, really great, you know? Is he genuinely, like, can City, and we saw this season, they were better without him in the team. And so you're thinking, is his time done? Foden looks so electric in the team compared to Sterling. Sterling came back in for the Champions League final and was terrible. And so you're thinking, oh, I don't know, Pep, what's going on here, man? What are you doing? But for what we've seen for England is, with the unquestioned backing of Southgate, Sterling has flourished. Now, it helps, again, I think a big factor is the fact that he's been in Wembley. He's been in his backyard. He said, didn't he, after the first game, he was like, I always said to myself, if we ever have an international tournament at Wembley, I'm scoring. Like, that's my end. That's my backyard. I have to score, right? And so having, for most of England's games at Wembley, I think has motivated him to really be at his best, right, and try and score. And, you know, but look, he only played, like, what, 648 minutes in the Champions League this year, 2,500 in the Premier League. So he played. He was consistently there, but not really, like, as a focal figure, especially at the end of the game. He was only playing in the league games at the end of the season, which were basically the league was wrapped up for City. Wasn't really playing in the Champions League. But you know what's weird is I think that sort of, not sidelining, but the way that Pep didn't feature him in the big crunch games most of the time at the end of the season, I think actually helped him, because he's come into this England team without the wear and tear. He's obviously played all season, but he's not had the full effect of the wear and tear of a very long season. Like Marcus Rashford has been ground into the dust by Man United basically by the end of the season, right? And you can see he was awful in the Europa League final because he had nothing left in the tank, and he's not really been used for England at all. Not even off the bench, because there's nothing there. He's very tired. He's not very sharp, not very focused. Harry Kane, again, he's scored 3 goals the last 2 games, but he's basically been rubbish in general play, if you look at him, because he's been so, he's tired. He's not fit. Sterling, however, is coming into this tournament relatively healthy, not really burdened by, I mean, the Champions League final defeat, but not really burdened by any sort of excessive stress from having played in loads of high-profile games and everything. And he's relatively mentally fresh. And you can see what he's delivering is this amazing, wonderful tournament. He's England's player of the tournament, although I'd say Shaw has been better than the knockout round so far. But overall, taking the whole tournament in, Sterling is England's player of the tournament. He's making a very great shout, considering Paul Pogba's out, to be player of the tournament overall. Let's see how far England go to decide that. But yeah, he's having an amazing... It's Summer of Sterling, was the commentator said, didn't he? And it is the Summer of Sterling. And you can't help but feel good for him, because he's a great person, great human being, very charitable person, does amazing work in the communities and stands up for himself, and had to endure a barrage of racist abuse from the media, of the British media. He's risen above all of that and he's trying to make a better world for everyone else, not just on the football field. And you can only admire a man who does all that. And he's a great footballer as well. You know, so hats off to Raheem Sterling. I'm not wearing a hat, but if I was, I would take it off to Raheem Sterling.
I think it's almost like a perfect storm as well for Raheem, is because it's like, you know, he has a point to prove. He was linked with Spurs in a swap deal for Harry Kane. I don't think he would have taken that too kindly, to be honest with you. And while he has that point to prove after not playing that much last season, he also has, as Mo said, the kind of unquestionable backing of Gareth Southgate. So you have this kind of dual thing where you have a point to prove. You're definitely kind of, you know, full of ambition to show what you can do. But at the same time, you have that kind of safe backing of a coaching staff. And also, of course, he's in, you know, as Mo said, he's in his back garden, basically. Like, so it's a real kind of potent storm. And I think that he's almost like the kind of the face of this English team in many ways, because, you know, he was a trailblazer to speak out about the kind of, you know, the racist treatment that young black footballers were receiving over the last, you know, decades from the British media. Like, he was the first one to do it. Like, he actually opened the conversation on that in many ways, you know. So I think it's very kind of fitting that he's finally getting his recognition this summer, and I'm interested to see what he'll do next season, because I don't know if he's going to stay at Man City or what. It seems to be that he's going to be leaving or something, so I'll be interested to see what his next move would be.
Ewan, looking across to Denmark, obviously Christian Eriksen has dominated Denmark's tournament for almost every single area that they've been involved on the pitch, off the pitch, in terms of their dealings with the media, their relationship with the Danish fans and the Danish public. But on the pitch, something that's become quite apparent is that without Eriksen in the team, Kasper Hjulmand has been forced to reshuffle in terms of personnel and in terms of tactics. And he's changed the team in order to get the best from his wide players. And we've seen, you know, we talked about a summer of Sterling before. This has kind of been a tournament of wingbacks, or a tournament of fullbacks. You look at Di Lorenzo and Spinazzola for Italy, Shaw and Walker, or Shaw and Trippier for England have been really, really impressive. But Jakob Meyler on one side for Denmark and Jens Larsen on the other have been absolutely potent. And when we spoke to Michel Davidson in the previews, a Danish journalist, he said that one of Heumann's biggest pluses so far in the job is that he's made the team less reliant on Eriksen. And obviously, the situation that happened at the start of the tournament couldn't have been foreseen, of course. But given the fact that they do have a much stronger plan B now, going into this game against England, in the past, that had inevitably been a focus on shut down Eriksen, shut down Denmark. That's now no longer the case.
No, absolutely. And this is the thing, as the weeks go by, we learn more and more about these Danish players, ones that maybe we don't see all that often. Maybe they don't play in the big Champions League nights. And, you know, your guys like Dolberg and Damsgaard are now the heroes of this Danish team. And I think many people have come to love these guys and the spirit they have in the team. And also just a bit like Raheem Sterling, that they're really good footballers as well. And I think you're right, they're onto their plan B, but their plan B has been their plan since the very first round of this tournament, since the very first match, basically. So they're on to their plan B. They know the plan by now. They know the system. The team sheet more or less writes itself, maybe bar a couple of injuries. Daniel Vaz played some games earlier in the tournament. More or less it writes itself. England is still, as we've discussed, is you don't know exactly what personnel will come in, and then there's the talk of do you go to a back three for this game against Denmark. I think for a game like this, you go with the team that you know, you go with your setup you're comfortable with. So I think the Denmark are going to be playing their plan B, which has become their plan A. England don't want to play a plan B that is one that they're not too familiar with as yet. So really interesting one. Denmark have obviously got through a tough game against Czech Republic. Different kind of game, different kind of opponent. An opponent that, at least in the sense of putting balls into the box, is a bit similar to what they might find against England. But also England obviously a lot more advanced through the middle of the park than the Czechs were.
It's going to be really interesting watching Denmark cope with England, because as you say, I thought for the most part they handled the Czechs crossing very well. Simon Kjær is huge, Andreas Christensen is huge, and Yannick Vestergaard is even huger. So they really lived well, they really handled well the crossing, except for one time, obviously, when they got one cross to Šek and he scored. But that wasn't an error cross, it was a low cross down to his feet and he scored, he bodied it home. So what interests me is if England have been sending these high balls, and obviously England's set pieces, we've discussed this, I think Denmark will defend that quite well. I think where England could have some joy is, as we saw against Germany, and as we saw almost from Czech Republic, is like with low crosses, maybe try and test on the ground. Because in the air, those three are phenomenal. They're very fierce and very ferocious. Simon Kjær is in incredible form, getting his head to everything. Christensen, as we've seen with Chelsea in the Champions League final, nothing phases him. He's very young, but he's very composed, very talented young defender. Vestergaard, we know, is a pro. He's probably the weak point of that defence, but he's also very, very good on the ball. And, you know, because Ralf Hasenhüttl's education at Southampton, so he's a fantastic footballer. Denmark are a very, very good team. There is no real weak point in the team. Well, the weak point was, sorry, that's not true. The weak point was coming to the tournament, can they score the goals, right? Because Yusuf Poulsen was the striker. He's okay. And Kasper Dobber was the backup, and he was a faded former, hot prospect. So you're wondering, are they going to score goals? Yusuf Poulsen had 3 goals in the first 3 games, right? And then he got injured. Oh, no, what are you going to do? Kasper Dobber comes in 3 goals in the next 2 games. So they found the goals. Dolberg in particular is looking very sharp. Poulsen came back from injury off the bench against Czech Republic and looked amazing, incredibly mobile. So that's going to be a concern for England, because this is the thing. The one weakness I've seen so far in England is there's space behind John Stones and Kyle Walker. Space behind them, space around them. Germany did it, exposed them 2 or 3 times down there. Couldn't make the most of the chances, but did it. And Czech Republic, and Ukraine, as we said, made hay behind Stones and Walker. All for that first half. So there's a weakness there. And if England switch to a back three, which I think they will, because Denmark play a back three, I think Southgate will want to match up with them so that they can't outnumber England that wide. Then that means the whole right side of that defence is very vulnerable. And you get Joachim Mehler running at them. I mean, this is where you start to think, why didn't you bring Wan-Bissaka, Gareth? Because then you could have just said, all right, Aaron, mark him. Don't let him get away. And then you mark Joachim Mehler, and then you do take a lot of threat out of Denmark, because Joachim Mehler is the outlet, is their creative force, the same way Spinazzola is for Italy.
Alan, when you look at the Denmark team, and as Mo said, there are these names, Schmeichel, Andreas Christensen, who's obviously just won the Champions League, Yannick Vestergaard at Southampton, Pierre-Emil Højbjerg at Spurs. They won't pose a lot of surprises for England, but likewise, particularly in comparison to other teams that England have faced, there's so many players in this Denmark team that will say, oh, I know you from the Premier League. I've marked you before. I played against you. I know the runs that you make, the movement that you like, etc., etc. And particularly this idea of not necessarily crosses into the box, but just balls into the box. Christensen, Kjær and Vestergaard, as Mo said, will eat them up. And you look at the way that England have played, there's not been a massive amount of variation in terms of playing through the lines or looking to draw defenders out. It's generally been about using speed in behind fullbacks and getting either across to the head or across the box for someone to finish. Particularly if you look at Kane's goals, that's where he seems to be getting the most joy. Arguably so far, there's not been a defensive unit better set up to prevent those types of goals from being conceded.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that Schmeichel's role can't be underestimated either, to be honest with you. I think that he's a really interesting character. I think from a young age, he's been fueled by this kind of desire to step out from his father's footsteps and kind of prove that he can be his own man. And he proved that by going down to the lower leagues and working his way up and going to Scotland for a while and working his way up. And I think that, you know, his kind of almost adversarial personality, I'm pretty sure that he'd be drilling into the guys, you know, into the likes of Højbjerg and Christensen, the guys who play in England week in, week out, that it would be really special to kind of spoil England's party, to go and beat them at Wembley when the whole nation is in this really positive mood about the national team. I think that they'll thrive on that kind of, you know, as I said, adversarial, kind of almost contrarian mission, if that makes sense, you know. And I mean, like, Christensen is a Champions League winner. I mean, he's not going to be averse to playing in big games. Højbjerg is quite kind of a snappy figure. You know, he's quite aggressive. He kind of plays on the edge. I think that he also takes to it. He won't be daunted at all. And they say familiarity breeds contempt. And it definitely breeds a bit of a lack of fear, I would say, in the way they approach that game. And I think the character of the Danish team, while they are very likable, I don't mean to be too Roy Keane about this and just talk about character and all that kind of thing, but I think that they actually are quite an aggressive team. Like, they're a very likable team, but they're not choir boys. You know, they're tatted up. They're ready to play too. So I think it's a really potent combination. We have the narrative. We have the tactical nous. We have the individual ability, the collective spirit, but also that little bit of edge, you know, the thing that everybody was giving out to Ciro Immobile for at the weekend. So I think it's going to be really interesting. I'm really looking forward to seeing how they match up. I think it's far from a far-gone conclusion. And I really feel like if any team has a narrative this summer, if any team has a chance of upsetting the odds in a tournament where we've consistently seen the odds be upset, it's Denmark.
Right. Crunch time. Obviously, in previous rounds, we've gone through predictions. And we've been quite free and easy with it because there's not been an enormous amount riding on it. That is definitely not the case this week. Ewan, I'm going to go to you first. England, obviously, pushing for their first ever European Championships. Denmark pushing to get into their first final since 1992 when they won it. How do you see this one going?
Yeah, I'm with what Roy just said there about the character and the spirit. I think that's important. So, and I think they have that in abundance. And I don't know, maybe it's my head, maybe it's my heart, maybe it's neither of them too switched on to it. But I have a feeling about Denmark. I'm going all in on Denmark. I'm going to have a big breakfast with, you know, bacon and lurpak and pastries and stuff on Wednesday and see what this team can do. I think they cause an upset, and I think Denmark do it at Wembley.
Okay, Eurovision style, that's one vote for Denmark. Mo, over to you. England or Denmark?
Weirdly, it's my head that says Denmark and my heart that says England rather than the other way around. I've been thinking the whole game, ever since I watched Denmark turn it around against Russia, I've been thinking, don't count these boys out. There's something about them. They're not just got a narrative behind them. They're a great team. Logic. When I think about it logically, I'm like, they're just going to counter England, and they were hitting them where it hurts in the soft spots behind Stones and Walker and Pickford. We saw it. We finally saw it. He had a moment against Ukraine. got away with it, but he came out. What that was. Yeah, we all saw it. Now, it was just the one moment, and Ukraine weren't good enough to punish him, but we saw it. Now, if that comes back against Denmark, that's going to get punished. So those three guys were basically what knocked England out of the World Cup, right? And they're still together in that same little part of the pitch. So I just worry about them in semi-finals, and I think but my heart says England, because I think England have just got so many good players, so many great players. Phil Foden hasn't even played since the second game of the tournament. He's still there to come off the bench, an X factor. Jack Grealish, obviously, at Wembley is just God. Like, he comes on and the whole stadium just stands up in glory. Sterling is great. If you're really struggling, you can, I mean, I don't think Sancho will start, but you can bring Sancho and Rashford off the bench. Again, we've seen what Sancho can do. Rashford is the most clutch striker England have. If they really need to, they can bring Calvert-Lewin on. You know, aerial bombardment. They've got so many options, and I just feel like England are going to win. So, and because I know, I can always guarantee what Alan's going to say and what Ewan said, I will back England in this one. I will say 1-0 England. I think Gareth Southgate will score. It'll be a very exciting first half an hour or so. England will go 1-0 up, and then England will be just like, oh, no, shut up shop. And it'll be awful for the rest of the last hour. Harry Maguire will have like 17 clearances, and then they'll win 1-0 to go to the final.
Yeah, I'm pretty confident that I know what Alan's going to say as well. But I'd also say I think Luka Modric should have something to say about the three players that knocked England out of the World Cup. Alan, I'm pretty confident I know what you're going to say. We've got one all so far in terms of predictions. You've got the casting vote, England or Denmark?
No, I think aside from what I said earlier, I think it would be England will win. I think that I think they're going to the final. I mean, obviously, I'm an Irishman. I'm from Cork. Like, I'm hoping Denmark win, to be completely honest. Like, but I just feel like the English team has too much talent going forward, and they have too much in reserve. And I feel like the way Southgate has set up his team, they won't be rash. They won't go, you know, hammer and tongs in the first half. They have a game plan. They play it quietly and build slowly. They'll be very, very hyper aware of embarrassing themselves on their own soil. And I think that, you know, with the likes of Grealish completely rested against Ukraine, you know, Phil Foden to come in as well, I just think they'll have too much going forward. And I think that Denmark's lack of kind of presence in the final third will be their hamstring. So I have to go for England. Despite what I said, I think it's going to be a very tight game. It's going to be a very interesting game, very competitive game, tightly fought. But I reckon that England will win out in the end.
After you and Solders all down the river, I'm going to back you and I'm going to go for Denmark. But I think it's going to go all the way. I can fully see this being extra time and penalties, but I'm going with Denmark to give us the edge.
Fergal, it's coming home, Fergal. Technically, actually, it already has come home. Because if you remember, the song was not never about left. Winning the tournament.
Wait,
it was about the tournament coming to England.
Can I change my vote? Can I change my vote?
No.
It's already come home. This is the thing. The song was about the tournament being hosted by England. So technically, it's already come home, lads. It's already come home. Forget the fact that England might win it or not. It's already come home, even if Denmark win it. So there you go. The more you know.
The more you know, indeed. Right. Songs that have lost relevance and the chance that Denmark could make the final. But as Alan Feely, quote, has said, England will be into the Euro 2020 finals. We're going to take a quick break. After the break, we're going to be looking at who will be the other finalist. Spain up against Roberto Mancini's Italy is sure to be an absolute cracker. We'll be previewing that in just a few seconds. Hello and welcome back to the Squawker Talker Euro 2020 preview. It's the semi-finals and we've already looked at England's massive, massive Wembley clash against Denmark. And the other semi-final is coming home. It's staying at Wembley as the rest of the tournament will be played in London. But this one has got a distinctly Mediterranean feel. Spain up against Italy. Italy powered their way right the way through the tournament as Group A winners. It's been a slightly stickier road from Spain as they qualified in second place from Group E. Italy, we're going to get ourselves started. Ewan, we're going to go to you first on this. The kind of only concern really for Italy heading into this game and heading into the Belgium game in the quarterfinals is, were they a little bit undercooked? The group was very straightforward for them. They just motored on through. Austria didn't put up too much of a fight in the last 60, and I know they had to get through extra time, but generally you felt that Italy had control of the game. Up against the FIFA-ranked best team in the world, they were faced with their biggest challenge so far. The way they managed the Belgium game has given us an insight into what other gear this Italy team has. We've seen how impressive they've been. Mancini full of passion, the fans, the players seem absolutely up for it. But against Kevin De Bruyne and Romelu Lukaku, they've demonstrated that there isn't a team in Europe, possibly even in world football at the minute, that they don't have a system to contain.
Yeah, they did really well against Belgium, you know. Two teams going into this one. This was the one that was hardest for everybody to predict. This was the one I think most people were most excited about from the quarterfinals. And they dealt with them. They dealt with them really well. De Bruyne and Lukaku had, you know, some chances in the first half. Not talking about the penalty that wasn't a penalty, but in normal play, they had some chances in the first half, but that was kind of the plan, was let them have a little bit of the ball, but when they get closer to us, we're going to shut them down. We're going to leave Jeremy Doku completely open, which was a bit of a problem because he woke up and just decided to be Messi for a night. That caused him a bit of a scare, but generally it worked. They decided to focus their energy on containing De Bruyne and Lukaku, and it worked. And I mean, it was the kind of game that, you know, there were moments where things could have changed. It was very back and forth. It was really fun to watch. But it just showed you that Italy, they can deal with a team that attacks them maybe more than they attack the other team. It is a case of Italy stepping up a gear. Against Spain, it's going to be different as well. It's not necessarily stepping up a gear from Belgium, but it's a different gear. It's a different kind of vehicle altogether. Spain, the challenge they'll pose with dominating possession, being a bit slower, that's a different challenge altogether to anything Italy have faced so far. But they faced this previous big, massive challenge against Belgium perfectly, I think. And now they go into this one full of confidence, ready to try and go toe-to-toe with Spain, putting those two midfields against each other.
Yeah, before we start the inevitable Pedri loving, just to quickly say on Belgium.
This is a record. This is really the earliest we've got into it.
Yeah, before in the podcast, with last podcast, I said that I thought Martinez, Belgium win, because I thought Martinez would put Doku in the middle and he would terrorise it in the middle. Doku terrorised Italy, but from the left. If he had put him in the middle, like I said, they would have scored, because you could see Di Lorenzo had very little answer for Doku, but he had to keep beating Di Lorenzo to get at the centre-backs. If he had been played in the middle and he was just running at the centre-backs, he could have done some serious damage. They didn't really have an answer for him. So I'm really annoyed at Martinez, because if he'd just made that one switch, like, he could have won the game. As it was, Belgium, I thought, were good, considering the fact that De Bruyne was playing with an injection and really can't have been anywhere near his best, but he looked really good. Lukaku was really, really sharp on the break, but not quite sharp enough. But they missed Eden Hazard. I figured they would, because how do you not miss Eden Hazard? But they really missed that sort of third player. And Martinez made some weird subs, right? He brought on Dries Mertens, and the game was going 100 miles an hour. He brought on Dries Mertens. I'm not sure that was the right move. Yannick Carrasco, I think, if he got on at all, he got on very late in the game. It was just unfortunate, you know. And they had some bad luck with injuries. Obviously, brought on Nasser Chadli, created a chance within 5 seconds, and then had to go off injured. That's a real shame. So they had some bad luck, but in general, they played quite well, considering the fact that they were basically up against the best team in the tournament so far. And I think it's just a shame for Belgium, because, like I said, I think I've said before, their whole team as a whole peaked in 2018, but they ran into the brick wall of Umtiti and Varane at the World Cup. And this, now their defence is kind of past it. Their attack is great, but they ran into the brick wall of Italy. Like, they've always had very tough draws. They never really had a sort of coasty, easy draw. Even to get to the quarterfinal, they had to go on the road constantly to Denmark, to Russia. They never played at home. So, you know, I'm quietly impressed by the way Belgium done the tournament, but they just didn't have enough punch at the end. I mean, and that was partly down to Martinez making some weird subs, partly down to injury, partly down to just bad luck, I guess, really. Italy played very well as well. You have to credit Italy. They were fantastic. So, Verratti got away with a little off-the-ball shove on De Bruyne when he was already on a yellow card. I thought that's the moment he's going to lose his head now. But then Mancini took him off before he gets sent off, which is smart management. See? Mancini, smart management. Martinez, not so much.
Alan, looking at the two midfields, there just seems to be an inevitability about the fact that that's where the game is going to be decided. Spain have gone with the same three right the way through the tournament. Koke, Pedri, Busquets missed the first game, obviously. But generally speaking, that has been the three. Italy have stuck with the same three for the knockouts: Barella, Jorginho and Verratti. Given the fact that these are two teams that rely so heavily on winning the middle of the pitch in order to progress higher up and create chances, Who has got the edge as it stands?
It's a good question. It's really a fascinating game, to be honest with you. I mean, Barella was speaking in the media this week about the Spanish midfield and how they've inspired him over the years. You know, the likes of Iniesta, Xavi, Busquets, and even the modern, you know, incarnation of Pedri and Koke as well. And how much he's loved watching them over the years, and how they've given him so much as developing as a player. I just think, you know, it's a very tough game to call in many ways. I think that defensively, Italy are in better shape. They have a better goalkeeper, and they have two centre-backs who are much more confident than Spain's centre-backs are. I mean, we can't even predict what Spain's centre-back starting partnership is going to be for the game. Will it be Garcia and Laporte? Will it be Torres and Laporte? Who knows, you know? So it's kind of a bit up in the air. Whereas I feel that the Italians, they're almost, you know, riding with inspiration all tournament, but especially towards these final few games. I mean, we saw Chiellini embracing Bonucci and Donnarumma, G'ing up the crowd after winning a goal kick in the last 5 minutes of the Belgian game. I mean, it's inspirational stuff, genuinely, you know. So I think that they believe like nothing else going into this game. In midfield, I think it's going to be a real battle, basically. I mean, it's going to be a real test for Pedri. I thought that he was maybe a little quieter against Switzerland than he had been throughout the tournament. But I still think he was very good. I think it's going to be a real test for him going up against somebody like Verratti in that kind of energetic role. And then obviously, of course, you have Jorginho sitting in that fashion. I think Busquets, as you mentioned, he missed the first two games. He's been superb since he came in. I think he does struggle sometimes when the game becomes a bit stretched. And if it's played at the pace that the first half of Italy-Belgium was, I think he could be exposed, which would be interesting to see. Obviously, Spinazzola not being there as a massive attacking threat neutralised. I think it's going to be a lot of it's going to be dealt with the coaches too, in terms of how they manage the game. I mean, in-game management and stuff. I think that Luis Enrique and Mancini are atypical in that they're the two best coaches in the tournament. And they're not actually national team coaches. They should be working at club level. Busquets was speaking this morning and Dario asked, and he was saying that, you know, it's very unusual you have a coach of Lucho's caliber working with us because normally they'd be in a club job. Like, he is a phenomenal coach, as is Mancini. Both have a club job left in them. They're not in semi-retirement. They can go back tomorrow to a top European club. And I'm really looking forward to seeing that battle of wits. I think they're two completely evenly matched teams in many ways. Both rely on their midfields. You know, they have flaws in various parts of their attack, you could say. I think a lot of it's going to come down to not just what happens on the pitch in terms of not just how the midfield dominates the game, but also how the coaches use the teams and how they set up the teams going into the game.
Ewan, as the guys say, it is going to be won on thin margins. There's so much talent in almost the same areas of the pitch for both teams. And an interesting one to look at in terms of injuries and how things can have a bit of a domino effect. Spinazzola, we now know, won't play. He's going for surgeries, possibly not even going to be fit again for the start of next season. That opens the door for Spain. It's probably going to be Emerson Palermi who comes in. He replaced him in the Belgium game. And anyone that's seen him playing for Chelsea knows that he's quite rocky defensively. But as Mo said, in the wide areas, Spain haven't really looked consistent. It's either been Torres or Sanabria. There's a potential injury doubt with him as well. But given the fact that Marcos Llorente has been so brilliant for Atletico this season in that high, wide right position, he started the tournament at right back. That was more of a means to an end with no Carvajal. Azpilicueta's come in and done what Azpilicueta does, which is he's a solid citizen. He does his job, minimum fuss. He's actually been quite self-deprecating, saying that he hasn't really maybe done it for Spain as much as he would have liked to in his career. But given the fact that Italy are incredibly hard to break down, someone like Llorente, who's been almost reinvented this season by Simeone, could he be an option to come into that place to benefit from the fact that defensively Emerson is quite weak?
Absolutely. I think this is what Spain have to do, is especially if Sarabia is carrying a knock, you don't want to play someone who's not 100% in this game. So you play Marcos Llorente because you want to make the most of that just tragic, devastating injury to Spinazzola. But if you're Luis Enrique, you've got to make the most of it. You know, Italy have given him a bloody nose in the past, so he can literally swing as well and he can swing as well and give one back. I think you have to put Marcos Llorente in this game to attack that side, but do it as the right forward, or don't do it as a right back. Azpilicueta's been fine. He's been good. He's done nothing wrong to nothing to merit being taken out. And what was interesting in the end of the Switzerland quarterfinal was how Azpilicueta was moved over to centre back to fill in there for the final moments. And you know, that's not the best starting partnership, I don't think, of Laporte and Azpilicueta. They've also hardly played together, but it's something you can do later in the game if you have to, if somebody's absolutely knackered, or if you want to take off one of Pau Torres or Eric Garcia. So you've got to have Azpilicueta in there. You've got to have Llorente to put him as the right forward. You can adapt the shape a little bit. Football formations don't have to be symmetrical. You can make it asymmetrical. Mm-hmm. That's what Atletico did all season. You've got to have Llorente in there to try and make the most of it, because that's a weakness to exploit for sure.
One of the biggest examples of Enrique's man management has been his dealings with Morata so far in the tournament. You know, the famous quote earlier on in the tournament of talking about Morata plus 10, you know, he wouldn't drop him. He wasn't interested in the criticism or the abuse that Morata was receiving. There's no danger, Ewan, that Morata will be dropped for this game. You'd fully expect him to start. Gerard Moreno came on against Switzerland, didn't really boost his case. He missed quite a few big chances. But there is one name that, you know, we talked about with England, names that are not being talked about, but there's one name for Spain that's not being talked about, that, and that is Mikel Oyarzabal. I know you, as a lover of all things Basque and Basque football related, are well in tune with him. He scored the fifth goal against Croatia to seal that win, and then he scored the decisive penalty in the shootout against Switzerland. Is there any danger of him getting a run out?
I don't think that's a danger from a Spain point of view. It could be a good thing. Oyarzabal's been great when he's come on, took that penalty so confidently, you know, representing Eibar on the big international stage. But I think it's going to be a case of Morata starts and then maybe gets taken out. Got took out quite early against Switzerland, you know, in the 55th minute, I think it was. And the cameras were cutting to him so much, and there's also footage going around of him during the penalty shootout where he's basically like a child who's been taken shopping for a Saturday afternoon and is absolutely bored, is fed up, and the parent is trying, right, just wait one more, stand up, don't lean, don't slouch, come on, we're almost there. Koki's looking at him like, come on, you need to show a bit of confidence for your teammates taking the penalties. And Morata was just not in that mindset. And I worry a little bit about Morata in this game, because who's he going up against? Two centre-backs who know all about him, who know his strengths and who know his strengths and, to put it bluntly, who know his weaknesses, who know how to get under his skin. And I think we've all said many times in this podcast, it's quite easy to get under Morata's skin. But if there's anyone who can do that and probably is used to doing that on a Wednesday morning at training, it's Chiellini and Bonucci. So I'm interested to see how Morata copes with that, because he's going to get fouled a lot. Does he have the mentality to shrug it off, stand up, put the ball down and do it again? We'll see.
But equally, that's the thing. He knows their weaknesses, right? He's training with them every week, twice a week, three times, four times a week, whatever it is. He knows their weaknesses, and they're both old men. They can't run worth a damn. Like, you saw Lukaku flipping, had his way with them physically in terms of pace, but like obviously they got back because their teammate Spinazzola was there. Spinazzola made some big defensive interventions on the cover, stopped Lukaku scoring a tap in. You know, he made a goal line clearance, and he's not going to be there. And Emerson's going to be there. Emerson's a rubbish defender. He's a Brazilian fullback. You know, so what do you expect from this guy? Italian international now, but he runs forward like he's a great attacking player. He'll be decent in attack. He'll maybe won't recreate Spinazzola exactly, but he'll be useful in attack. It's defensively I'm worried about for Italy. But for Spain, that's good. And I would even go as far as to say that Mikel Oyarzabal, yeah, definitely he should be coming on. But Adama Traore, if there's ever a game for Adama Traore, this is the game for Adama Traore. You bring him on, you put him against Emerson, 1v1, he's going to kill Emerson. It's just then you put him against Chiellini, he might just kill Chiellini as well. Chiellini's kind of old, man. He might just knock that guy down, you know, run through him like he does. Adama is a very specialised weapon, right? Very specialised weapon. And you have to be ready to A, have a right back that just covers him and doesn't actually run beyond him, because he needs to go one-on-one all the time. He doesn't defend very well. And you need to have a left back and a left centre back that aren't very especially quick or good at defending. And all of that is the case right now. Spain have Azpilicueta, fantastic defender. Spain and then Italy have a weak left back, and Chiellini is not the quickest, not the most mobile, right? I mean, Cesc Fabregas tore Chiellini's hamstring in the Euro 2012 final, for God's sake. So it's possible to get at Chiellini. I think if there's not to start, don't get me wrong, not to start, but as a second half sub, if you're going to bring anyone on to come on and really run up those Italians, I would say Adama Traore. Morata is obviously interesting because, like you said, they know how to wind him up. Can he resist that? Because he should know how to wind them up tactically. He should know how to get in behind them and cause them problems. We saw against Croatia, remember, he only scored once. He could have scored like four. He kept killing them on the break. His movement was amazing. Switzerland were a different challenge, obviously. So not so much joy there, but you know for me you start with Marcus Llorente. I agree with you guys, Marcus Llorente, and then obviously Ferran. Ferran has to start because he's the most lively of the wingers, right? Dani Olmo didn't really look at it, you know. So whatever, Morata, Ferran, and then Marcus Llorente, and you bring on Oyarzabal left wing. And then you bring on Adama Traore. And I think that's the way you can maybe hurt Italy. The question then becomes is, can you keep them? Can you cope with their press? Now, I'd imagine the midfield can cope with their press because the midfield are all press resistant. But can those defenders, can Laporte cope with their pressing? Jordi Alba, I mean, very, very, very good in attack. But we've seen how many Champions Leagues in a row now? Teams press him and they get joy. You know, and Liverpool, PSG, Atletico Madrid, who else? Who else humiliated Barcelona? Bayern Munich. So it's like, this is, There's a proven method. That's what I think. He might even start Gaia, honestly.
Yeah.
Roma. Yeah. Roma didn't press Alba so much. They pressed everyone else. They went. But yes, basically, if you press Jordi Alba, and Italy are great, a fantastic pressing team, you can get joy. So I worry for Spain dealing with the high press. The midfield, they can handle the press all day long. And Unai Simón has shown very great courage passing the ball out and great ability. So I'm not worried about him. It's just the defence. I'm worried about how they're going to handle the Italian press.
It was a split decision, obviously, for England against Denmark. So before we wrap up, we'll do a quick round robin on this one. Alan, we'll start with you, then Ewan, then Mo. Obviously, Alan and Ewan, Spanish football, La Liga is your bread and butter. But don't feel obliged. Alan, Spain or Italy, who's going through to the final?
Well, I love Luis Enrique and the Spanish team. I've been following them really closely all throughout the Nations League, throughout the World Cup qualifying, Euro qualifying. And obviously, I have sympathies with them, but I think Italy... I backed Italy before the tournament. I think they're going to win it. I still think they were going to win it. I think they have the best team. They're playing the best football. I think that Spain's moment will come. I think they've had a good tournament and they can finish it with a positive vibe. And they've kind of not won the public realm because they never lost the public, but they've got the public on side with this new iteration of Spain. And I think the World Cup in 2022 with a hopefully fully fit Ansu Fati leading the front, I think they'll do serious damage with Lucho on the bench. But this summer, I can't see beyond the ever stylish Roberto Mancini and the Italians, the passionate Italians.
A vote for style and a vote for Italy. That's 1-0 Italy. Ewan, would you agree? Or are you sticking with your home team or de facto home team, Spain?
No, do you know what? When Spain went through, I thought, okay, whether they play Italy or Belgium, that's it. But I think the Spinazzola injury is so massive that I think it swings it for me. If Luis Enrique can exploit that properly, which who knows, he's a curveball, you never know, but if like he puts Llorente or like Mo was saying, unleashes Adama Traore in the proper way, I think you can exploit that and win the game. So you know what, I'm going for Spain. I think they can pull what I think is an upset, because Italy have to be the favourites, but I think Spain do it, because that's a huge blow for Italy to lose one of the best left backs of the whole tournament.
Mo, big decision on you. One each for Spain, Italy. Who are you going for?
Euro 2008, Spain 0, Italy 0. Spain went on penalties. Euro 2012, Spain 1, Italy 1 in the first game of the tournament. Spain 4, Italy 0 in the final of the tournament. Euro 2016, Italy 2, Spain 0. Right? Conte's revenge. It wasn't really Conte's revenge. He didn't lose in 2012. But yeah, Italy got the revenge. It's the fourth Euro in a row. They face each other. It's going to be the fifth match. But, you know, and you know, look, everything points to Italy. They're the best team in the tournament. They have been the best team in the tournament. They've played the best football. They are the most cohesive. They don't really have any massive weaknesses except for pace up front, and the team best equipped to take them out with the pace up front bottled it back in the round of 16 against Switzerland. So objectively, you're thinking Italy. But again, like you, and I've got a feeling about Spain, man. It's Luis Enrique, when a team buys into what he's selling, and it shows the degree of the mental strength that he has and he possesses, I just, you know, you just can't write them off. I find it impossible to write Luis Enrique off. Like, again, 6-1. That's all I have to say, right? And you look at the midfield. The midfield is so good. Busquets is like, this is his last hurrah, basically. There's no way he'll be the starter at the World Cup. Rodri will have taken over by then. Busquets is like on his last leg. This is his last hurrah. Pedri's ascension. The midfield, they'll match Italy. Italy haven't had anyone match midfield. Spain can slow the game down in midfield. No one, Italy have not faced anyone that can slow the game down in midfield. Yeah, everyone else has tried to either sit back and defend or just fly at them repeatedly like Belgium did. Spain can go, no, slow down. Take this thing out of the press. And when you do that, Italy might revert to type and just like they did against Belgium at the end, just all park the bus and panic. And if this Italy team doesn't press, they lose a lot of their potency. And, you know, it's just a matter of I'm backing Lucho to find the right combination of forwards to do the damage to Italy's back line with that weakened back line, no Spinazzola, obviously. So I'm saying Spain are going to win. I don't know what the score is going to be. It probably got extra time, maybe even penalties, but I'm back in Spain. Lucho's going to do it, man. Just don't, you can't write that man off.
Yeah, I've decided to forgive Alan for backing England, and I'm going to agree with Alan. I'm going for Italy. I just think, yes, the Spinazzola injury is a bit of an issue, but aside from that, and it is a big at and a big if, I just think they look bulletproof, and I just can't see Mancini getting his suit dirty for anybody. So I'm going for Italy into the final. But as has been proven on previous podcasts, we are generally completely wrong. So we will be back later on this week to preview the final, where two of these four teams will be playing. You can see how right or how wrong we are then. My name's Fergal Brennan. That's it for today. Alan, Ewan, Mo, thanks so much for your time and your insights.
No problem.
Thanks a million.
Cheers, guys.
Great stuff. And don't forget to check out the final preview show that will be out later this week, looking ahead to the big, big showdown at Wembley. Will England be involved? Will it be coming home? Let's face it, we haven't got a clue. But make sure you tune in and listen to the show then.